Well, good morning. Thank you for coming. My name is Joshua Weed. As you said, I'm a Master's of Science in Mechanical Engineering candidate at Baylor University. You know, when I saw that I was going to be the only one during this session, I was a little nervous. I immediately recognized an advantage and disadvantage. The advantage being anyone that came is just here to hear me talk, so thank you. The disadvantage is I can't claim anybody that might have come for someone else. So my research is focused on the processing issues of using natural fibers in fiber-reinforced polymer composites. And I won't be getting too much in the technicalities of the experimentation that I'm doing today, but rather speak a little bit more towards the motivation and what I hope is the motivation of future research for this. And my advisor is Dr. William Jordan, that you may have heard speak Saturday on Christian Humanitarian Engineering. So thank you for being here, Dr. Jordan. The title of my talk is Natural Fiber Reinforced Composites, Ascribing Global Economic Value to Unique Renewable Resources in Developing Countries. And before we get started, I really wanted to highlight the scripture that has led me on my education path, what I hope to be my career path, but also just really fits the subject area extremely well. And it's what Jesus kind of presents himself, and I think that he calls us to be Christ-like in this way. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, Luke 4:18 and 19. When we talk about developing countries and the poor in the developing countries, we're often burdened, and sometimes rightfully so, by what is simply the tragic nature of the poor in developing countries. And so today, I wanted to start off with some maybe more encouraging statistics about the poor in developing countries. The World Bank, last year in their annual report, reported some encouraging findings about the number of poor people across the world and in developing countries. So here you see on this first graph is just across the world that the number of people below $1.25 per day in the 2005 parity has dropped fairly significantly. And not only that, but the poverty rate itself in the developing world from the 80s till 2008, which the study stopped at, it's dropped from in the $2 a day category from 70% down to below 50, really below, just under 50. And then for the dollar and the quarter day, from around that 40% poverty rate to down to just below 30. And this is really great news. It's really encouraging. Another encouraging news that we find, it comes from the United Nations in their Human Development Report of this year. And this one focuses on the gross national income per capita. So we're really focusing on exports that developing countries putting out, maybe investments that are coming in, et cetera. And this focuses on the Human Development Index, you may have heard of a little bit on Saturday. But really, this is all areas of that HDI. There's some varying degree of increase. In the high HDI, there's significant increase. But even in this low HDI, you can't really tell here, but there is increase. This is sub-Saharan Africa, and this is in that low HDI category. And we see from really the late 90s a steady increase. And this is just, I want this to lift your faith a little bit and be encouraged that we're stewarding developing countries and we're doing it increasingly, and we're doing it well, but nevertheless, 50%, 30% poverty rate is still discouraging. It's still not where we need to be. And so let us continue to steward and continue to bring good news to the poor, as Jesus calls us. So when we look at a stewardship model for developing countries, I find there to be really two key areas, and these understand are going to be very inclusive of multiple disciplines. So you see engineering up here, but that's going to include geologists, that's going to include environmentalists across the board. Okay, and then economic development here, that's inclusive of maybe government development in fiscal policies, etc. Okay, so in humanitarian engineering, I just for example wanted to put up Engineering for Change. They're primarily sponsored by American Society of Mechanical Engineers, sponsored by quite more. Really what this organization has done is connected people and has connected engineers across the world to solve problems, to come up with solutions that maybe somebody has found in one developing country and that can be used in another developing country. And this has been critical in addressing immediate daily needs. Okay, so these are food needs, mobility needs, similar to Amos Winter's recent all-terrain wheelchair. Okay, another good example of this is Engineers Without Borders. Okay, very similar tactic. They focus maybe a little bit more on sustainability. On the economic development side, I focus just a little bit more on the development of microloaning and how that's affected developing countries. A big good example of this is the International Development Enterprises, started by Paul Polak. And this really focuses on rural farmers and using some humanitarian engineering, such as drip irrigation techniques, and giving them microloans so that they might invest in those techniques, and then those techniques would expand their farms, and they could make money to pay off the interest on those loans, as well as begin exporting. Another microloaning we see is Kiva. Kiva is very popular as it's taking advantage of crowdsourcing. So we can take advantage of that globalization of crowdsourcing and identify just personal people, you and me, that can interact globally with people in developing countries. Now, when we see these two interact, we see that economic development spurring on humanitarian engineering, that engineering like irrigation spurring on more microloaning, we really identify what we can call as appropriate technology. And we can see this multidisciplined approach to stewarding developing countries. Now, I want you to note here, what we don't see is stewardship in the global economy. Okay, so we do see globalization when it comes to the personal, just average Joe in the developed world, microloaning, et cetera, or donating to appropriate technologies. But what we aren't seeing is stewardship of the developing country itself exporting. So we want to look at how foreign investment can play a role in appropriate technology. And the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN actually published a book on this last year on the trends and impacts of foreign investment in developing country agriculture. So whether we're stewarding them or not, developing countries are beginning to step into this global economy. Okay, FAO states, it has also been shown that FDI, foreign direct investment, works as a means of integrating developing countries into the global marketplace and increasing the capital available for investment, thus leading to increased economic growth needed to reduce poverty and raise living standards. Here on the left, you see trends in FDI flows to three of the primary locations, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, over the last 30 years. And especially in the last 20, we see significant increase in FDI. Okay. On the right is a graph that I've just made from the large data sets that they've collected. And these are just a few of the developing countries in their data sets that show some of the most significant increase of FDI. And this is the FDI stocks contributing to their GDP. Okay, so now a large bulk of their GDP is coming from FDI stocks. There were some developing countries in this data set that weren't an increase such as great as this. Senegal, for instance, increased. So it went from that dark green in the 1980s, increased in the 1990s, but then maybe decreased a few percentage points in 2000. So this isn't worldwide, but it is the majority of developing countries, as stated by the FAO. Something to note is that FDI involvement does not always mean release from poverty, does not always mean poverty reduction. Just because there's economic growth or pro-growth approach does not mean that there's a pro-poor approach. Okay? And so this FDI involvement is critical, but we need to be stewarding it in order that it is pro-poor and in order that it is developing poverty reduction. Okay, so we look back at this classical model, and I just suggest that we add industry-leading innovation into the mix. Okay, so we look at what's new in industry, what's leading. For instance, the McLaren new sports car that uses carbon fiber composites for the chassis. Okay, this is cool stuff. This is brand new coming out. The carbon fiber composites are lightweight, but they're still strong, allowing that car to go faster. And how can we involve this in this appropriate technology approach? And that's really what I want to talk about with you today. when we look at developing countries, we recognize immediately they're agrocentric, right? And so what are ways that we can move them to a global economy, emerge them in a global economy, and have industry leaders invest in them? And so we, Dejanvre and Sajoulet from the World Bank identify that agricultural growth actually is fairly significant in poverty reduction. Overall GDP growth, and they're talking about Africa specifically here, coming from agriculture is 2.7 times more effective in reducing a dollar per day poverty in the poorest quarter of countries. 2 times more effective in the richest quarter of countries than growth coming from non-agriculture. Okay, here they're specifying a little bit more on food export, the idea that if we invest in their agricultural growth, not only can they help themselves and feed themselves, but then they can use that to export in GDP. And maybe let's think about how we can apply that agriculture to industry-leading innovation. So we got to think about some unique renewable resources found in these developing countries. First, I just put a banana up there. Banana is certainly not necessarily unique to developing countries, but it is very prevalent across the world. Okay, so when industry is considering resources, they're going to want to see lots of prevalency in order to invest in. Coconut is definitely much more unique to developing countries as it can only grow in certain regions of the world. Okay, there's jute and sisal. Jute is a vegetable plant that we actually use the fibers to make hemp rope. Okay, sisal is an agave plant. And these are obviously not as common, so let's take advantage of their uniqueness. The reason I've chosen these four to put up here, these are FAO stats. The reason I've put these up here is actually for two reasons. One is that we can use parts of these plants that aren't being used already. Okay, with the banana tree, the banana leaves they use very commonly for their own purposes. The bananas, the many different types of bananas, they use to feed themselves and then also export. It's a very large export. Okay, but the trunks, they're not using the trunks as well as we could. And so the trunks of banana trees are actually hollow. They're moist. Okay, they can kind of peel like celery. But we can take the fiber out of that. And the same way with coconuts, the husks, we can take the fiber off the husks. Obviously, fiber is already being used in jute, but we can take fiber from sisal plant as well. And those fibers actually exhibit pretty impressive mechanical properties. Okay, obviously, coconut's going to be the most of that, but very strong mechanical properties. They're stiff. Okay, when we're chopping up, they can be quite stiff. And so we can use these in replace of those kinds of strong fibers that we develop synthetically here in the U.S. And so one of the great ways we can do that is through fiber-reinforced thermoplastic composites. So just a brief, what are thermoplastic composites? They're what they sound. They're plastics. Okay. There's a couple different types of plastics. There's thermoplastics and thermosets. Thermoplastic just means that you can cure it more than once. Okay. The applications that we use these composites for is we put them in our automobiles, children's toys. Of course, we have to mention the 787 Dreamliner, which is 50% composite. Okay, these thermoplastics, children's toys are often fairly neat polymers. They're not as much composite. But when we get into these things like the plane, we need things that are going to make them stiffer, more structurally sound. Because currently we don't use composites for structural reasons as much as we do for aesthetic reasons or, very lightweight children's structural. So why would we want to reinforce these with fibers? So your neat polymers are going to be fairly flexible. They have a good strength-to-weight ratio, but not enough to replace something like a steel. Okay, so we can reinforce them with fibers and give them a much higher strength-to-weight ratio. Okay, and so that's why they're using the carbon fiber reinforced, and that's incredible strength to weight ratio. They increase the stiffness. Okay, so if we have, let's say, a flexible or fairly flexible case like a Tupperware, but we need a hardened case to hold our camera, okay, we can reinforce that, make them stiffer. For the most part, they can be low cost. Obviously, the carbon fiber is not going to be low cost in any way. But fiberglass is fairly low cost and things of that nature. Okay, this is the kicker, adjustable mechanical properties. We have the technology to inject or mix or extrude these fibers into composites. in a way that we can define the exact volume fraction. Okay? And that volume fraction can have a huge range of mechanical properties. So where if you need a specific application, you could look for different polymers, different types of polymers, or you could take a polymer and the fiber you need and adjust that accordingly. Okay? So I'm going to walk you through an example of the materials that I'm personally using just to show you the benefits of using fiber, and not only that, but using just natural fiber. Okay? So I use low-density polyethylene. This is a very common commodity polymer. You're going to find it in plastic wraps. You're going to find it in children's toys, in some soda bottles, not all of them, but some of them. And you're going to find it in Tupperware, though after the plenary speaker the other day, I'm going to have to take this photo off my list if we start using carbon dioxide. These engineering properties are really important to me, maybe not as important to you. These two right here I want to emphasize. So the tensile strength of LDPE, as I've tested, is around 18 megapascals. Okay, that's pretty low. The modulus is about 277 megapascals. So let's compare that to the banana fiber that I'm using. So as I said, this...
Modulus?
I'm sorry?
What is modulus?
Modulus is going to be your strength over area, okay, over a very specific... fiber reinforcement. So this banana fiber that I've extracted, we've extracted from the bast of the tree, which is the inner bark, and I'll talk you through the process here in a little bit. Just from my own testing, so here's that banana fiber. My testing is fairly comparable to literature in this. The strength, 650 megapascals to compare to 18. Okay. Modulus, 30 gigapascals. Compared to 280 megapascals, okay? And this is actually mid-range to low for fiber reinforcement, okay? So for synthetic fibers, we're going to see much higher than this. But in natural fibers, we can still gain significant improvement, and we can they can be much lower cost, okay? Just for fun, I wanted to put up this SEM photo of the cross-section of banana fiber. And this is going to be important for my own research. All of these gaps in here is just where the water would come up through the tree, right? So let me talk you a little bit through the production life cycle. We start at raw material, okay? This is Jovan. He lives in Uganda. He lives in Kapchora, to be exact. I had the opportunity to spend a couple weeks with him and live with him and his family. And he has a very large banana plantation, okay? And so they use everything as much as they know how to of those plants, okay? They're always making hats with their banana leaves. It's crazy, the innovation that they have with them. And part of his production, he keeps for his family. He's a leader of his clan, so he gives it to his clan. And then a good chunk of it he tries to export, okay? What he's cutting up right here is actually that inner bast, that part of that trunk. So every time you get a bunch of bananas down, 1 to 3 bunches means you have to bring the whole tree down. Okay, so trees come down all the time. And this trunk, right now he's cutting up to feed to his cows. Okay, there's virtually no nutritional value in those trunks. So they're worthless to the cows. The only reason he's feeding them is so they can get rid of it. Okay, so let's take that trunk and let's put it through an extraction process, and this is a very low-tech extraction. There needs to be a lot more work on this for the safety, if anything. But we put it through rollers, and we can extract these fibers, and we let them dry so that the pulp comes off of them, and we just have the processed fiber here. Okay. So this fiber is what they can then ship to wherever that industry is that's investing in them, can buy that fiber off of them, and then processes into plastic pellets, okay? This is one of the most common techniques for the plastics industry right now is injection molding, and that obviously that's only for thermoplastics. But this is actually coconut in, I believe, polypropylene. And this, so this is processed into pellets, use an extruder method, and you process them. We can take that, we can injection mold it, which, as I said, is by far the most common method right now, into a part of your choice, okay? Most common applications right now are in the automobile industry. In fact, Society of Plastics Engineers has a whole section devoted to this industry, and a whole section of that industry is devoted to natural composites, right, to put them into vehicles, et cetera. I know there's Natural Composites Incorporated, which has branched off from Baylor University, and they've sold to companies like GM. Okay. Okay, thank you. And this then goes to the consumer. Okay. Yeah, sir. Yeah, that's a great question. Just as I mentioned that there's adjustable mechanical properties in the volume that we put in, there's also many, many lengths that you can use here. Okay, so there's chopped fibers where you can chop them up extremely small. Maybe a millimeter sounds large, right around there. Okay, then there's short fibers that are going to range kind of up to the 5 to 10 millimeter range, and long fibers that are even longer than that. Okay. So these right here are going to be chopped in the pellet form. For the longer fibers, you would put them in thermosets. You would use resin for those longer fibers. To branch off a little bit into what my own thesis is processing issues. So one of the primary problems with processing natural composites is, as I showed you in that SEM photo before, there's a lot of moisture involved in natural plants. So lignocellulosic fibers, they're inherently polar and they're hydrophilic, so they absorb a lot of water, okay, and they still retain that even after they've been dried for some time. The majority of your thermoplastic polymers are nonpolar and hydrophobic. Not all of them, but most of them, okay? Most of the commodity ones, anyways. And so these are not going to want to bond at all with this water. So what we have provided by Jacob et al. Is this region that's virtually void. Okay, so you have the deformities of the fiber creating space between that polymer and the fiber. Okay, the problem with this is it dilutes the composite itself. It reduces those mechanical properties in the composite. And so we want to drastically improve that bonding in order for industry to see this as an acceptable product. And so there are a lot of methods already out there, chemical solutions such as an alkaline or a silane treatment. Okay, but these chemical solutions actually destroy the lignin in these lignocellulosic fibers. You just killed your mechanical properties. Okay, and so there's new research, and this is research that I'm working on in using different methods. Currently, I'm working on a maleic anhydride approach, and I'll probably be expanding before my thesis is over, of just bonding these two in a way that retains their mechanical properties in order that this product is value to the industry, okay? So we're going to take this unique resource, make it appealable to the industry, and I suggest that as a form of appropriate technology. So thank you for your time, if you have any questions. Yeah?
So I found it interesting, and partly because I got to work on the Dreamliner or a small part of it.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I'm just curious, like, you know, I see a lot of people, the Christians, doing humanitarian type things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can the person do, for instance, that, you know, is pretty tied down? Like, I can't really go on trips overseas a lot. You know, I have a family and all. You know, are things like Kiva, like, or other, you know, funding some of these projects, is that one way, like, for Christians to be involved that maybe can't always go on these trips?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really great point, especially for industry leaders, right? So people that are involved in the industry don't have as much flexibility. And actually, you brought up Engineering for Change. I would recommend that as one of the primary places for engineers to get involved that can't go on these trips, right? So Engineering for Change not only provides ways for people to go on trips, provides education, but it provides connectedness. And there's several bulletin boards on there. You can post questions. So if, say, hey, I'm in this developing country, I have this problem, what is the technological solution to this? Okay, and then someone in industry can just get online and respond and say, hey, this is what we do. Maybe we can work together and find a way that that can work in your developing country. And I very much support Kiva. I think it's a really great idea to microloan. It's not as an investment, right? So for the general user, you're not getting any return off of it. But Kiva does do a very small interest rate for the actual person, and that's how they keep themselves running. And the benefit of that is when you're investing in people, that they are, you're putting hope in them. You're encouraging them to say, hey, I trust you to give me something in return. And so that encourages them to follow through with what they've set up to do. So I would definitely recommend both of those. Yeah. Yeah.
That might be so you don't have to maybe extract off as much water from this, so that something that would maybe with more hydrophilic, more, you know, hydroxy groups or something that could bond.
Right.
With that, without all the water extracted.
Yeah, there are. Polylactic acid, for one, is a hydrophilic polymer. Okay. The reason I'm focusing on bonding from the hydrophilic to the hydrophobic natures is because they're not commodity polymers at this point. So that would be research into pushing them more into the commodity industry. But in order for really these leading industries to want to step into a developing country to find a resource, they're going to need something that's very prevalent already. So that would be one reason we're focused on this. But yeah, you're right. There's PLA. There's a couple others that I can't think of off the top of my head that are hydrophilic, and they actually bond quite well. Okay, so yeah, so I do apologize for presenting it that way. I personally agree with you. Maybe a way that I could better express it is that as we invest in them, we're investing in their culture that's already developed.
Those that need to go on to another talk, we keep talking, but feel free to go ahead.
I have one quick question. Why banana as opposed to coconut size allergy?
So coconut has already been developed through Baylor, and it's now a separate company called Natural Composites Incorporated. So that's basically a done deal, okay? And honestly, for me, banana was Dr. Jordan's my advisor, and he had started that, so maybe he can answer that question a little bit better.
I've been to Rwanda 5 times with engineering mission projects. I try to think through, what does Rwanda have in abundance there and I use it? And it's the banana plant.
Wonderful.
Not unique to Rwanda, but many other places. I just saw the stock either being thrown away or burned away and not even used for fuel.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, I'm familiar with Walter Bradley's work.
Okay. I can't promise that. I will have graduated, hopefully, by that point.
We have scholarships for young people.
Okay. Sure, yeah. I'm not informed on the exact species of the different bananas. I do know that the fiber that I can gather is very similar across the species. Okay. I don't know where you've been able to go. I've spent about 4.5 months in Uganda, and during my time there, there are a bajillion species of bananas in these developing countries, right? So we have a lot to choose from. We're not going to be stuck to a certain species. And hopefully you're not eating the plastic, so hopefully that won't be too much of a problem. Yeah?
Is that fiber any use for, say, garments?
Sure. Actually, you can already buy clothes that are using banana fiber. That's something the undergrads found in their research a couple years ago. So people are using it. It's not that it's not being used at all. It's just that. Yeah, it's so easy, yeah. Okay. Well, great. Thank you.